Welcome everyone to Spotlight. We're delighted that you could join us today. Want to thank Dennis for recording for us today and for the purpose of archiving, and Mar for our backup. We'll ask that you hold your questions for our guest today until the end of the interview. And with that, I'll turn it over to Steve Pallett.
Okay, thank you, Becky. And it's nice to be back once more doing a Spotlight interview. And today, I'd like to introduce you to a very, very familiar voice on For the People. In fact, it's probably one of the very first voices I ever heard on For the People, and it's Hallie Richmond. Hallie, thanks for agreeing to be interviewed, and of course, as always, I'm going to start by asking you where and when you were born.
Well, thank you, Steve. I was born in Hives Hospital in Houston, Texas, on November 19th, 1960.
That's very precise. And have you any brothers and sisters, or are you an only child?
I have one sister, and I had two brothers, one of which is no longer with us.
Okay. And your parents, can you tell us a little bit about your parents? What occupations did they have?
My dad was a mechanic, and my mom, she had a series of different jobs. She was a waitress, and when I was around 10 or so, she went to work at like a little truck stop kind of place, and she held that job for just almost 20 years before she finally was unable to work anymore.
And Dad, what did Dad do?
My dad was a mechanic.
Okay. Have you always had problems with your eyes? I mean, were you blind from birth?
Yes, I was. I was born 3 months early. I was a twin. I had a twin brother. And my twin lived for about 12 hours. And when I was born, I weighed 1 pound, 13 ounces.
So you're one of the oxygen blind babies, as indeed there are a great number of oxygen blind babies in the world, especially born around about that time. Do you know whether you had a fight on your hands to survive, or did you pull through pretty quickly from that very, very tricky start in life?
Oh, it was a fight. From what I have learned from my mom and my grandmother when she was alive, my mom didn't hold me until I was 8 months old. I was in the hospital, of course, and apparently the nurses had to, they put gloves on to turn me over and do what they needed to do, and I had feeding tubes that were placed on top, you know, they went into the top of my head. And my mom said when I was born, I couldn't wear any of the baby clothes she had made for me, so I got doll clothes instead. And when I came home at 8 months old, I slept in a dresser drawer instead of a crib.
Yeah, he must have been extremely small in those days, Hallie. So you obviously did survive and started to flourish after that point. What are your earliest memories? What can you remember from your very early childhood? Anything in particular?
Well, I didn't walk until I was almost two. I think I was maybe a little slow at that. I think my earliest memory is of people talking and telling me stories, and I love to be with the older people because they did talk so much and they did tell me stories just about life, just about their experiences with life, and I've just always been fascinated with that. And I think that's where my love of reading began, was just listening to them talk about, you know, their everyday lives.
And as a child, because of this very fragile start to life, you had to endure, or your parents had to endure with you, of course, were they ever protective towards you, or did they really let you do normal childhood things? Did you get into any scrapes, or were you protected, rather?
Well, they tried to protect me, but I was a very willful child, even from a young age, and I did basically just what I wanted to do. I remember when I was about 4, my grandmother just loved for me to come over and spend the night at her house, and I loved to go over there because I got treated special. I had no other children to try to compete with, and it was just me and her. And on this one particular day, I think it was a Saturday morning, I told her, I called her Nanny, and I said, "Nanny, I'm going to go to the store for you." And she said, "Okay." Well, I had said this before, and I played like I was going to the store, you know, and all. And she was cleaning house, and she said all of a sudden it got real quiet. And she said she just happened to look out the window, and she said, "There I was just walking across the street to this little store that was just directly across the street from her house. It was like a little convenience store." And she said, "I was just walking along, just crossing the street, and luckily, of course, there were no cars coming along." But she said she ran out and, you know, grabbed me just in time, and of course I got a whipping for it. But so I've always been, they've tried to protect me, but I've always tried to break out of that and do just what I wanted.
Do you remember a time when you suddenly realized, because, you know, if you've been born blind and you've never seen, I think we've all had this experience, was there ever a point when you realized that you were different, that you couldn't see, and that people around you could see? Can you remember when that actually dawned on you?
I think the first time that I was really aware of it was when I went to, at the age of 6 years old, I went to the blind school in Austin, Texas. And I saw all these other kids, and they were bumping into things and bumping into me. And I think that's when I really realized that I was just like them.
Yeah, so up until then, it hadn't really, you know, occurred to you that you were maybe a little different to other kids. You say you went to school for the blind. Was that very, very far from where you lived in Houston? I say Houston, and you always laugh at me, but however you say it, was that very far away?
No, it was about 3 hours away. And like I said, I went there at the age of 6. And I didn't come home on weekends like most people did, most children did. I stayed there for the most part. There was a few weekends where I came home, but not many, because once I got there and I discovered that there were all these children and they were like me, I didn't want to come home. I wanted to stay with them because they were like me, and I found that I fit in, you know, with them better than I did with my siblings.
So you found the residential school experience quite enjoyable then, as a small child. I'd say it's unusual, but, you know, many people have the opposite opinion. But you seem to like it. You settled quite easily then.
I did. It was when I got older that I began to not like it. But when I was a very small child, and I did love it, and when I had to come home for the Thanksgiving holidays and Christmas and sometimes Easter and in summer, I really didn't like it. I went home because I was made to go home. But I always was really anxious to get back and be with other blind children.
Going back to those early days when you were at residential school, is there any particular thing that you enjoyed above all others in the lessons field? What were your favorite things to do?
Well, to be honest with you, I really didn't like school much. I didn't like the academic subjects when I was younger. I know after my first year of school, when I came home for the summer, my mom had somehow found out about the library here that gives out the talking book machines and the books, talking books. And she ordered them for me. And when they came in the mail, she told me, "This is for you. This is your machine." And she showed me how to operate it. And back then they had the real heavy records. And from that moment on, that was it. I mean, I did my schoolwork like I was supposed to for the most part. I mean, there were times when I slept off, but I wanted to read. That was all I wanted to do. I cared nothing about learning. I just wanted to read.
But I think, you know, as blind people, we get a lot of our education from listening, from the radio, from the TV, from books, as you say. So you were probably absorbing stuff without really realizing, but in a different way. So it probably did you a lot of good, you know. You probably learned far more than you actually realized. Looking back on those days, I bet you learned quite a bit from listening. So it wasn't wasted, was it?
No, it wasn't. And I'll tell you this, too. I had a very good librarian, a very good lady who was a librarian. Her name was Miss Owens. And she really made an impression upon me at a young age. I would come into the library and I would ask for books. And she found me books that were for my age group. And there were a lot of nonfiction books in there about kids who had different disabilities. So she encouraged me to read a lot of those type of books. And of course I had, you know, the fun books also, but I read those and so you're right, I did learn through reading, and that was the way I loved to learn. I didn't want to go and sit and listen to somebody talk about, you know, this or that. I wanted to learn it through books. So yes, I did learn quite a lot.
Let's move on just a little bit now, Hallie, and come towards the end of your time at school. You say you weren't terribly bothered about the academic side, but were you given any career advice, or what was the plan for you as it came time for you to graduate from school?
Well, now, I went to public school in later years, but I do have to say here that I do really appreciate, I didn't at the time, of course, probably when I was a small child, because when I first got there, I remember wanting to go home and until I found, you know, other kids like me, and then I didn't want to go home. But I really appreciate my mom sending me to the blind school, because I think if I had went to public school first, I wouldn't have learned as much as I did. I think they had, I forgot what they call them. They were like teachers that traveled around and they came to your school maybe once or twice a week and they taught you Braille and the skills that you needed. But I think in my case, I needed to learn all that, you know, just concentrate exclusively on that. So I really am glad that I did get the opportunity to go to the blind school for the first you know, a few years so I could learn my Braille and my table etiquette and just things that blind children need to learn. If I had went to public school, I don't think I would have gotten near as much as I did at the blind school. But I did go to public school, and we had some people come in toward the end of my senior year and tell us about career choices. I remember we had one guy come in from wanting to recruit people to join the Navy. Well, this was a, you know, sighted school, so I can understand that, but I kind of got a big kick out of it. But we didn't have a lot of career advice, but we had some.
Oh, Hallie, that's made me smile. You know, I could just picture you in a full naval uniform. Now then, that'd be something, wouldn't it? Not a terribly good idea, would it? You could have been a navigator, eh? Now there's an ideal job for a blind person in the Navy. So anyway, apart from that nonsense, what was actually decided then? What actually happened after you left public school?
Well, after I left public school, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't really want to go to college. Looking back on it, I really should have. I probably would have been a lot further along today, but I didn't really want to go to college, so I was encouraged, you know, I was encouraged to go. So after high school, I went to this rehabilitation center in Austin, again, called Chris Cole Rehabilitation Center, for a course there they called College Prep, and it was to prepare you for college. Well, I was away from home and didn't have my parents breathing down my neck, so basically I learned a lot there. I learned quite a bit, but I also did a lot of partying and just having a good time, and I never got really quite prepared for college.
So you had a bit of a good time, did you? So what sort of thing were you learning at the rehab center? Was it like daily living skills, is that sort of thing, if you didn't do the college prep? I'm just curious as to what you actually did do there, and how long did it last?
Well, I took the college prep classes because that's what I went there for, but I knew that I wouldn't really use them. I did it because that's what they wanted me to do, but along with that, I had daily living skills. You know, they taught you some cooking. They taught you how to manage money, how to fold money. They taught you, you know, about banking. And one really neat thing they had, when you got good at the daily living skills, they had two apartments that were in the dorm that we lived in. They were at the end of this dorm. And if you passed all their little tests that they had for you, you could go and live in one of these apartments by yourself, and you had to cook for yourself, and you had to go out and buy your own groceries, and they were just trying to get you prepared to live on your own when you left. And so I got to do that, and man, let me tell you, I thought I was just it. I had so much fun.
Okay. And you were there for was it a matter of months or a year, or what sort of time scale are we talking, and what happened next after you left the rehab center?
I was there for about 3 months, and when I left, I came home. I was still living with my parents at this time. I came home, and I stayed home for maybe 5 or 6 months, and then I went to the Lighthouse of Houston, and I took some clerical training. And when I went the first time, I actually went twice, but this first time, they didn't have computers for us to train on, so we had to train on the manual you know, typewriters. We had electric typewriters in the class, but you had to be really good to get on an electric typewriter, so we had to just stick with the manual ones. I did that, and then I got out of that course, and I could never find a job, so I came back home, and then the next big thing I think I did was I went to guide dog school in California.
Okay, tell us a little about your experiences at the guide dog school in California.
Well, the guide dog school was really, really neat. I didn't bring the dog home. I thought that's what I had wanted to do, but when I got there and I really realized what all the training was and entailed, I decided after about 3 weeks that it really wasn't fair for me to bring a dog home because I didn't have real good mobility skills, and I knew that I wouldn't be getting out, you know, traveling. So I decided that it would be better for Ellie, who was a golden retriever, to go to somebody who could make more, you know, more use of her. So I left her, and it was really sad. I tried to get the guide dog school to let me have her and take her home as a pet, but of course they said no, and it was a very emotional goodbye. But I later found out that she went to somebody in Michigan who really used her for what, you know, she was intended to be used for.
I must say, Harry, that I really do admire you for making that decision, you know, for saying at an early stage that it wasn't for you. I think a lot of people would have probably gone through with it and gone home and been unsettled and, you know, really unhappy at having the dog to care for, which they didn't feel they could handle. So I do admire you for saying at an early stage in your training that it wasn't for you, and I think you're to be commended for that. Do you regret it now? I mean, would you in the future see yourself having a dog, or have you decided once and for all that a dog isn't for you?
Dog isn't for me. I just, it's just not something I would want.
Okay, that's fine, and it's everyone's choice, you know, to either have or have not the use of a guide dog. Now, when we spoke the other day, and we did our little chat before the interview, you did tell me that round about this period, I think it was round about this period, that you did actually do a job for a theatre, and I found that fascinating. Can you tell me about that?
Actually, that was before I, it was right after I got out of the Chris Cole Rehabilitation Center. I apologize, I had totally forgotten about this, but I'd gotten out of Chris Cole, and I was home with my parents, and there was I was looking for a job, and there was a lady. This was before I even went to the Lighthouse the first time for the clerical training. Somebody told me about a lady who was looking for a disabled person to work. Take ticket reservations, but they could do it from home. So I applied, and she came to my house and met me, and we talked, and she hired me on the spot. So for about almost a year, I took ticket reservations for this little theater called Country Playhouse.
And tell me how you did it in a practical sense. What actually happened? What was the procedure then? How did you actually do this job? It sounds fascinating.
Well, they installed, the company installed a phone in my house, and that was for, you know, my use when I was working. And people would call, and they would, the theater would forward the phone to my house, and they would call, and they would say, this is so-and-so, and I want to make a reservation. And so you would, I would write down the name, the date they wanted to attend the play they wanted to attend, how many tickets, and if they had season tickets, because a lot of them were season ticket holders. If they had season tickets, I wrote that down. Then at the end of the day, somebody would call me from the theater, and they would say, okay, I'm taking the phone off of forwarding. And so I would then give them the information that I had taken down throughout the day, and then they would go ahead and fill the ticket orders and stuff. And I was really lucky. I got paid really well for doing it. It was just a part-time job, but I got paid like as if it were a full-time job. So I was really well paid for that.
Yeah, sounds good. Sounds very interesting. Eventually, that came to an end, though, after a year. Why did it come to an end?
They were doing some changing and some remodeling and such, and they wanted somebody to come in and work a full 8-hour shift, but they wanted a sighted person because they wanted them to, in addition to taking tickets and reservations and such, they wanted them to do other things that back then the technology was just not out there for us to do. So we agreed that, you know, it would be best if, you know, I left and they could replace me. And they were real gracious about it and gave me a nice bonus and all that. So I got treated very fairly.
Well, I still think it's a very interesting thing to have done, you know. So that's very good. Okay, let's jump forward again now. And we've mentioned the fact that you went to the guide dog school and decided not to come home with the dog. What was the next major thing that happened in your life after that point, Howie?
Well, I didn't do anything for a few months, and then I went back to the Lighthouse of Houston. Now, we're talking, this would have been in the last part of 85 or the first part of 1986. I went back to the Lighthouse of Houston to take some on-the-job training. And through that, I worked in what they call a sheltered workshop. And while that was going on, I met the man who was to be my first husband. So we got engaged there, and I continued to work until just shortly before we got married. And then I was encouraged to stop working because in the subcontract, they called it subcontract work, you work, you get paid by what you do. And a lot of the people in there were very slow, and so they didn't mind paying them, but I was quick, and I was getting paid more than anybody in there, and they didn't really care for that. So I left there and started preparing for my wedding and got married, and then I became a homemaker.
Can we just backtrack just very slightly, and can you tell us what you were actually doing as a job at the lighthouse? You said you were working in the workshop. What work was it?
They had different, what they call contracts. They would bid with a company to let us do their work for them. And we did all kind of things. We did what was called winkler, and that is this plastic silverware, knives, forks, and spoons. And you count 50 of them, and you put them in a box. And then you count 50 more, and you put them in the same box, but you reverse them so that 100 pieces of this plastic silverware went in the box. And then you close the box, and you stacked it up, and you where somebody would come around and they would count your work at the end of the day, and you got paid by how many boxes of silverware you did. We did that, and we did some something with some plastic cups, and we did some record albums, you know, and we did all kind of just different little jobs like that.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for just filling in the detail there. It's always interesting to know exactly what people get up to. So you said you left there and you were preparing for your wedding and you became a homemaker. Where were you living at this time? Were you still in Houston?
Yeah, I was still in Houston, and I was living in a apartment building that was especially for the handicapped and elderly. And so I was living there, and then later my husband was living there with me, and then I eventually did go back to work on a temporary basis, doing the same kind of thing I was doing before, the workshop, sheltered workshop work. I came in when they had big orders to fill and they needed extra people. And I remember we did Christmas cards one year for this MD Anderson Hospital, which is a cancer center in Houston. And, man, I worked 7 days a week, you know, 12 hours a day. I made some good money at it. But at the end of it, I was kind of glad to give it up because that was very tiring work.
Yeah, because, of course, you were running your home and going to work as well. So did things carry on like this for the next little while? And, you know, what was the next major thing which happened to Hallie?
Well, that was just sporadic, you know, the work after I got married. I mainly just stayed home and just did what a homemaker does. But the next major thing was probably, let me see. That marriage didn't work out, so I got married again. And, well, actually, I met the guy who was to be my second husband, and we were together. We lived together for almost 4 years before we got married again. And during this whole time, I wasn't well, actually, that's not true. I was working. I met him and at the lighthouse again, because I went back there to take a course in customer service. And I met him, and shortly after I finished the course, I got a job working for the Lighthouse of Houston, but we worked in the VA building, so they contracted with the VA for us to work, and I worked switchboard there.
So back to the Lighthouse again. Did you find the switchboard work enjoyable? Did you enjoy being a telephonist, or was it a bit of a pain?
Well, I'll tell you what, I enjoyed my veterans. They were very, very nice people. A lot of them were very frustrated. They didn't feel like they were getting the help they needed. and I enjoyed trying to help them. Of course, you had, working with the public, you have some that are just not going to be happy no matter what. And I got, you take a lot of abuse, but you have those that are really good and really try to help you to help them, and it, the good outweighed the bad. So yeah, I enjoyed it very much.
And you did that for a fair length of time, did you?
I did that for almost 4 years, and during that time, I was became pregnant with my first child, which was a little boy, and carried him to term, but he didn't make it. So I stayed off for my 6 weeks and went back to work, and 3 months later, I was pregnant again with my little girl, and I worked all through that pregnancy, and I took my maternity leave to have her and stayed home with her for the 6 weeks and went back to work again and worked there until she was almost 7 months old.
Okay, now I've had permission from Harry to just ask a little bit about her little boy. It's probably very, very painful to talk about, but I have actually had permission from Hallie, and I think it's very brave of her to speak about it. Can you just briefly, Hallie, I won't stress the point too much, but can you just briefly tell us how on earth you coped with that, with the death of your baby?
I don't know how I coped with it. I just did. When I was pregnant, I had gestational diabetes, and I didn't even know what that was. And they didn't find out until I was like almost 4 months pregnant. And they told me, well, you have this gestational diabetes. And I was like, what? I've never heard of it. And they said, well, this is what you need to do to ensure that you have a healthy baby. Well, I followed it for the most part. But we had no idea that anything was wrong. All the tests said he was fine and such. But when I went into, when I went to have him, somehow the baby got in distress, was in fetal distress, and so I had to have an emergency C-section. And somehow the cord got pinched and his oxygen got cut off, and they tried to revive him, but it didn't work. So I didn't have to make the decision to keep him on life support, because I was glad I didn't have to make that decision. As far as coping with the death, I really don't know how I did it. It was something I had to do. I knew I had to go on, and I did.
Were you offered any help? Were you offered any advice, any counseling? Or were you just left to get on with it, basically?
Well, the social workers in the hospital said there were support groups I could go to, but they really didn't know how to cope with a blind person whose baby had died. They offered what help they could, and they gave me the names of some support groups, but I would talk to these people and ask to come to their groups, and they would say that I was certainly welcome to come to the groups, but they just really sounded like they didn't really know what to do with me. And I really felt uncomfortable because I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know what to tell them, so I ended up not going to any of them, and I just coped with it, alone.
Yeah, it must have been a dreadful, dreadful time for you. It must have been a horrendous time. And several years later now, what advice would you give, or do you think you could give any advice to anyone who's going through a similar situation or knows of a close relative that's going through a similar thing? Are there any words that you can offer?
Well, if I met another blind woman who was going, who would be going through the situation I went through, I would know that she would probably not be really thinking straight, and because she'd be trying to cope with the death of her baby. So I would help her get in one of these support groups, and I would do whatever I had to do to help her get in, because I think I really needed it, and I just didn't know how to. I just didn't have the fight or the will to fight to get into these groups. So if I ever meet anybody that is in that situation and they want to go to the support groups for the death of newborns, I'll do all I can to help them get in.
Okay. That's fine, and thank you very much for that. It must have been hard for you to talk about. Let's come on to something more cheerful now, because you said that shortly after that you had, well, you were pregnant again, and this time you had a lovely daughter. Tell us about your daughter.
Well, my daughter was born on February 20th of 1998, and I named her Le'Aaron LaRue Martin. And she is 5 years old now, and she's just the most coolest kid you'd ever want to meet. She's real special. And she's, I don't know, I just can't say enough about her. She's an amazing little girl.
yeah, I'm sure she is. And so you had the baby, and you raised her, and she flourished, and were you still working during this period? Were you still working at the Lighthouse?
Yes, I was working at the VA, you know, for the Lighthouse, but yes, I was still working, and I worked until she was almost 7 months old, and then I left that establishment, and I basically stayed home to raise her. And she did flourish, I guess you'd call it, and that's what I did.
Yeah, because it must be tough as a blind mum, you know, bringing up a child. Any funny things that you can relate, that you can tell us about, that actually happened? You know, did you ever get things mixed up and, you know, do anything amusing?
Well, yeah, there were quite a few little funny incidents I had with Miss Le'Aaron there. I used to try to keep her clothes in order, you know, so they would match, and she would look real pretty and cute when she was going somewhere, because I always wanted to show her off, and I still do, no matter how big she is. But I would try to keep all her clothes together, but she had so many. I mean, that little girl had tons and tons and tons of clothes, and so it was real difficult to keep them all together. And many times I would put clothes on her that mismatched and stuff. And usually if I was going out with a sighted person, they'd be nice enough to tell me that, well, she doesn't match or whatever, and I'd try to, you know, make her match and look, so she'd look real cute. You know, I'd put the little dresses on, or her little sleepers, or and her little shoes, and try to put little breadths in her hair, but I couldn't put breadths in her hair, because her hair is real thin, and they never would stay, so she didn't get to have the bows in her hair, and I really hate that. But and we had other little amusing things happen along the way.
No, I'm sure you did. Okay, so we've now got you with a daughter, and again, what was the next significant thing which happened in your life?
Well, the next significant thing was that marriage also too failed. So for a long time it was just me and my daughter. And during this time, that's when I found For the People. And when I first came on For the People, I was just so grateful to Jennifer that she had started this site, because I, like a lot of other people on here, really needed For the People, and I still do today, but at that time I needed it in a different way. And so I came on For the People, and I found a whole new group of friends, and my daughter would listen to me talk on the computer while she was watching her cartoons, and so she wanted to get in on the action, so she's talked on For the People here a few times. And then through For the People, I met my Steve, or the Shepherd Boy.
Yes, indeed you did. We'll come on to that very, very shortly, but I'm just curious as to know how you actually found out about For the People. You said you found out about it, but how?
Well, I was talking to my ex-husband one day, and I had been on another chat site, and I no longer wish to go there, but I was missing the chat sites. I missed talking to people. And I was complaining to him about it one day, and he said, well, why don't you go to For the People? And I said, For the People, what's that? And he said, that's another chat site. And I said, oh, okay, what's the address? And he said, it's forthepeople.com. So I said, okay, so I put in forthepeople.com and came up with all this strange stuff. And I would go to him and I would say, that's not a chat site. That it's this or it's this. And he would say, well, I don't know. And so I bugged him about it over the next 2 weeks. I would say, find out the address. I really want to go to that this chat site. So finally he got so disgusted with me, I guess, one day, he found it. And he said, it's 4-the-people.com. So I said, okay. So I put the address in and filled out the form to join. And when I actually got into a room the first time, it scared me so bad. I didn't realize, I guess, that I was in a room. And I heard these people talking, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm actually connected. And so I keyed down very shyly, and I said, can you hear me? And this voice came back and said, yeah, we can hear you. And I was like, I can actually talk to people again. I was so excited, and things have just never been the same since.
Yeah, I had a very similar experience myself. Yeah, amazing, isn't it, how we discover the peeps in the end, you know. Everybody has to find out, and when they do, they're never the same again. Okay, Mr. Shepherd, if you're there, you can cover your ears now, because I'm going to talk about you. When did you first remember speaking to the Shepherd Boy, Mr. Shepherd?
I don't remember the exact first time. I just remember, it seems like I've always talked to him. He would just be there, and I would, you know, I would say hi to him. And at first, I didn't really think much of him. I mean, I thought he was cool and all, but that was about it. I mean, it was like, oh, this guy's kind of neat, but he's all right. And so then it went on like that for a while, and then For the People, we thought we were going to lose it. And I didn't have MSN, and I was looking for somebody to help me put MSN in. Well, by that time, Steve and I had been talking a little more, and I had gotten to know him a little bit better. And so nobody would help me put MSN in, and I was mentioning it one night in a room, probably the coffee shop, because that's where I hung out mostly in those days. And Steve said, well, I'll help you. And I said, you will? And he said, yeah. Well, it took us two nights to install MSN. We had a lot of problems. And he finally helped me get it in about 2 o'clock in the morning. One morning we got it installed, and he asked to be my first contact since he helped me put it in. And I said, well, sure. You can be my first contact. That's no problem. And I woke up that next morning because I went to bed. I didn't know how to work MSN or anything. I just installed it, and I was so tired by then I went to bed. Woke up the next morning, and Steve was sending me an MSN message. And so I figured it out, and the rest, they say, is history.
So when did you realize then that this guy from Virginia was just a little bit special?
I think it was shortly after his mom died. She died on August 7th of 2001, and when I found out about it, I immediately got off For the People and went to MSN and was talking to Steve, and we talked just briefly, and then I didn't hear from him for a couple of days, and then when he did come back on, we talked some more, and gradually I just realized that, man, this guy is the guy for me. But I didn't want to tell him because I didn't know if he felt the same way, so I just kind of kept it to myself. But I made a point of trying to find him. But back then, he only came on, it seemed like, in the evenings. But I would look for him all day, you know. But it seemed like he came on just more in the evenings, and he would come on and stay on for just like a very brief period of time. And I would be like, when he would leave, I would think to myself, oh, man, why do you have to leave? But, of course, I couldn't tell him this. So I was, that's how that happened.
I think we get the picture, Holly. I think we understand what you're saying. Yeah. So, obviously, you know, your relationship developed, and then the time came that you met in person. I bet that was a bit nerve-wracking, to put it mildly, wasn't it? You know, to actually meet face-to-face.
No, not at all. Because by then, he came to visit me on October 11th of 2001. And we really weren't nervous. I guess because we had talked on the phone and talked on For the People so much, we were just happy to meet each other. There was no nervous. Nobody was nervous at all. We were just happy to meet each other. And he stayed with me for 3.5 weeks, and those were the best 3.5 weeks I think I've ever spent with anyone. That's where I really learned to laugh.
Oh, you must have learned well, because you're always laughing. It seems that you are anyway. So we'll move it on a pace, and you obviously decided that, you know, either he was going to come to live in Texas or you were going to go and live in Virginia. And I know it's a fair distance. I think you told me once it was about 1,300 miles, something like that, which to me, where I'm sitting, seems an enormous distance. So what major decisions had to be made when you decided which person was going to go and do the moving?
Well, there were a lot of things that I had to consider. I had a daughter, a very small child, and I had to consider her. I knew that I wanted to move to Virginia because it just seemed like that was the right place for me to be. But I had this little girl, And I made the decision to send her to live with her father and his new wife. I felt like they could provide better for her, better than I could. And even if I hadn't met Steve, he hadn't been in the picture, I still would have done this because I really felt like they could give her more than I could. So I sent her to live with her father and his new wife, and then I moved here to Virginia to be with Steve. And I still keep in contact with my little girl. We talk on the phone, if not every day, then every other day. We have a very good relationship, and so that's that.
Okay, that's fine, and you moved to Virginia. I remember you going. I remember you counting down the days. Apart from the obvious, you know, living with Steve, what are the major differences between living in Texas and living in Virginia? Is it vastly different?
To me, it is. I think the biggest difference for me is the humidity. When I lived in Houston, I was 50 miles from Galveston, which is the coast, you know, and it was so humid in the summertime, it was just, on some days you just couldn't even go outside. It was just so humid, and it was hard to breathe, and, I mean, they even had alerts to tell you to stay indoors and not to go out if you didn't have to, and that was just how humid it was. It was terrible. Here in Virginia, it's humid, but it's nothing like Houston, Texas. So I love Virginia, and I love Virginia's winters. Last year I got to see more snow than I've ever seen in my life, and that was real fun for me, because I'd seen snow in Texas a few times, but not a lot of it. But they had a lot of it last winter here in Virginia, and that was real exciting for me. I got to see lots and lots of snow.
And we're coming towards the end of our time now. I'm going to surprise you now, Hallie. I've got one or two questions for you now. It's a little new idea I've had, and I want you to answer them as quickly as you can. I'm not going to give you hardly any thinking time. Okay? What's your favorite food?
Fried chicken.
What's your favorite drink?
Coca-Cola.
Favorite smell?
Chocolate.
Favorite artist or artists?
That's hard to say. I don't know. I have a lot of those.
No, I didn't understand that. No, you've got to answer the question.
Well, I love country music, and I don't know. I think my favorite artist now, it used to be this Shania Twain, and I still love her, but on the male side of that, I think it would have to be an artist called Kenny Chesney.
Thank you very much. Okay, TV program.
Judge Judy.
Favorite season?
Winter.
And finally, your favorite time of day?
Day. I like the whole day. I don't like the night much. To me, it's a little bit scary. So I get the day, the whole day would be my favorite time of day.
Okay, good answer. Okay, Hallie, thanks a million for the interview. I know, you know, parts of it must have been very, very stressful for you, and I do thank you for that. Are you willing to answer any questions from this bunch of good friends here?
Well, certainly, and thank you for interviewing me, and I just want to thank everybody for being here, and thank you, Jennifer, for having For the People for me and all of us out there.
Okay, Hallie, thanks a million. It's a great pleasure to talk to you, and I always enjoy our chats, and, you know, we've been friends for a couple of years now, and hope we continue to be friends for many, many years to come. Thanks very much.
Now, Hallie, you know your favorite artist is Willie Nelson.
That's my least favorite. Don't let her fool you. I do not like Willie Nelson.
Well, I thought about suggesting it to you, but I thought I hadn't better.
I would like to say that I find Hallie and Steve a few of the most friendly people on the site. There are a lot of friendly people, but Steve has helped me more than you can think on with computer problems. And Hallie's always out there to talk to you. And so, thank you, Hallie.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for the compliment.
Good old guy.
Good interview, Hallie. Good interview.
Goodbye, Jill Thornton.
Good interviewer, Steve. Thank y'all so much.
Yeah, I really like your rapid-fire questions at the end there, Steve. I want to thank Hallie for, first of all, for being my friend. We call each other sisters of the heart. Great big thanks for that. We've helped each other through bad times and have awful good times together, too. But also thank you for being part of the management team and for the people. Thank you, Hallie.
I have a question and then a follow-up, please. My question is, do you cook fried chicken? Do you cook your own fried chicken?
Yes, I do.
Well, my follow-up is, would you leave Steve and run away with me?
No, I won't do that, but I'll one day maybe cook you some fried chicken.
Okay, I'll settle for the chicken.
Hi, Sister Hallie. That was a wonderful interview. And I know you're a wonderful lady, because you're my friend.
Well, thank you, Lee.
Well, Steve's an excellent interviewer, and it was a good interview. But I'd like to do it all over again, and I'm going to do the interview.
Yeah, that was really a great interview. I don't usually get a chance to just sit and relax, but my wife is away for a week. I'm a bachelor. Oh, I'm going to enjoy this week so much. So, but you started off right with a really good interview.
Well, thank you,
Hallie, and thank you and Steve for being two of my best friends on the site. Don't want to get mushy here, so I'll just close, but thanks, friend.
Well, thank you, Sharon, and we think a lot of you also.
Hallie, this was my first time in Spotlight, and I just want to tell you I especially like the story about how you and Steve met, you know, and you moved over there, because I'm an internet relationship, in an internet marriage as well, and I thought that was really good. And Spotlight, I like this. I think I'll come back and hear some more of these. So good job, Hallie. I know that was a lot, you know, all the questions are being fired at you, so.
Well, thank you, Jessica.
Yeah, it was a good interview, Hallie, and good job, Steve, as well.
Thank you, Terry.
Hallie, you are a beautiful person, and the only reason I'm saying this, the love that you have for Steve and letting him share it all with the people on For the People. You share him so much.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. You know, I love a lot of people in my life, and Steve is, of course, the most important one. And, you know, I wanted to mention my little boy, too. Just because he's no longer with us doesn't mean that, you know, he will be forgotten. So to me, I've had two children, just one didn't make it. But I'll always talk about him, and because he is a part of my life. And I talk about the people I love, that's for sure.
Yeah, nice interview, Hallie. Thanks very much. Nice one, Steve. That was lovely.
Thank you there, Mr. Kant.
There are 32 people in here, Hallie. Were you nervous?
No way, because I know most of them. So, no, I wasn't nervous. I enjoyed doing it.
Nice interview, Hallie.
Yeah, she didn't sound nervous at all. But, Hallie, I would like to compliment you as a mother myself on what you did for your little girl. And that was a very unselfish thing that you did.
for your daughter. And I had to do a similar thing with my daughter, not quite as young as yours, but anyway, we've talked about it. But anyway, I think you're a great person.
Well, thank you, Patty, and I think same of you.
And Steve, I think I slipped off the key. I wanted to say that you did a super job also.
Well, Becky, I see you've left the chat room, so I want to thank everyone for coming. Thanks to Steve and Hallie for a wonderful interview, to Dennis for recording, and Mar for recording as well. And it's great to have a spotlight back after a summer respite. So take care, everyone. See you back in 2 weeks.